good to know. Yeah.
Welcome to the Babbelry,
where translators visit the Tower of Babel.
The Tower of Babel.
The Tower of Babel.
Babel.
Babbelry.
This is your host, Suki Wessling. Interviews are often formal affairs where the interviewer has written questions and the interviewee is ready with rehearsed answers. But I've always tried to encourage a natural flow of conversation on the Babbelry. Today's guest is a great conversationalist and a little less than obedient interview subject. Here's how we started after I asked her to introduce herself to listeners.
Hi, my name is Merle Hoffman, and I do some of this, a little bit of that, a lot of this other thing.
I ask my guests to forego the elevator pitch and instead imagine they are summing up who they are and what they do in a casual way. Merle had a good reason for not wanting to start off with her accomplishments.
I just don't like to, you know, jump right into to everything that I'm doing. It tends to either intimidate people or make them nervous. So I try and, you know, low-key it in a way. Somebody say, what do you mean? Oh, I write, I opened the first legal abortion facility. Oh, well, that gets, you know, some response. And what do you write? And, you know, I'm a wisdom seeker. I read a lot. It's sort of what do you do? What do you do? Who are you? You know, it's one of these existential questions.
Clearly, what Merle has done in her career is built on the foundation of the singular person she is. Merle Hoffman is a person who asks questions like this of someone she just met.
You know, am I the same person today that I was yesterday? I don't know.
I hope not.
So anyway, that's what, it depends. Sometimes I play with people. I like to play with people.
Before I loose the reins and let Merle play, I'll give you a bit of a preview of her work. Merle saw the future when the state of New York legalized abortion in 1970. She opened her clinic, Choices Women's Medical Center, when there was no field of study called women's health. She had to set professional practices for a procedure that had only been done in secret. She defined how to provide women's health care, and then she stepped into the political arena to fight for her right to provide and our rights to receive appropriate care. An easy woman doesn't do this work. Merle is a difficult woman, an intellectual, a fighter, a woman who trusts herself. If she offends you here, she probably won't care because it's not her job to take care of your feelings. It's her job to make sure that women have the right to feel, the right to live their lives, the right to be their singular selves. And Merle, I hope you enjoy as much as I did getting to know this singular, accomplished woman. I want to actually start by quoting you.
Okay.
In an interview you did, I heard you say this. I don't have too much trouble with difficult people, being one myself. So what is important about difficult people and especially difficult women?
You see, a difficult person is not a difficult person to themselves, right? A difficult person is a difficult person interactionally. Now, why are they difficult? Because they may be more internal. They may be someone like myself who sort of likes to play with reality boundaries or socially expected boundaries. They may not give answers that are expected. So that makes them difficult because people are conditioned to respond to others in a very sort of trained, conditional way. I studied for in graduate school social psychology, and we studied endings, you know, how you end a conversation, a relationship, whatever. And what I did with a colleague of mine is we would go into a restaurant and we'd have a dinner and then we'd pay and then we'd leave and then we'd come back and then we'd have our dessert. You see, and that really, you know, it's just sort of changing those expectations. Or when somebody says, hi, how are you doing? You tell them, you know, you usually say, oh, I'm fine. You know, it's a little bit of trouble. And then you can say, well, I went to this doctor, I went to that doctor. Just sort of exploding those socially accepted, responses. But these were basically experiments, and most people don't do that. I sometimes just do it because I like to mix it up, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's difficult because it makes a person think. Mm-hmm. And thinking is probably the most difficult thing of all. And thinking is the one thing that our society, particularly now, doesn't want anybody to do. So, you know, enough things to get your mind off yourself or thinking of what's really happening to just go along. So thinking is really important to me.
It is. And so the other half of the question was, what's especially important about difficult women?
Well, women are difficult in and of their being, aren't they? They're difficult because, what is a woman? And you get to a point where somebody is, you know, in front of congressional committees and can't answer that question, or when it becomes a question, or, you know, Freud, what do women want? You know, it's our power to create life, you know, our differential from the male, you know. I mean, I'm going to be called an essentialist. I'm not an essentialist. I do believe in facts, scientific and biological facts. The fact that men just, you know, they just can't keep their pants closed. I mean, look at these Epstein file situations. You know, they're driven by this enormous sexual urge, you know, and, that's the difficulty. I mean, they're the difficulty. Women trying to control it, stop it, navigate it, compromise with it, that becomes difficult. I mean, women wouldn't be difficult if we didn't have to, you know, have a social situation where we're always trying to accommodate the male drives for power and control. You know, I don't think there would be that much difficulty. It's an issue. It's a problem. You know?
Yeah. And that's a really interesting way to put it, because I was thinking from the other side, you know, that when we step out of line and when we insist on things that our society, that patriarchal society doesn't want, that's when we become difficult. But I love
your... But who's setting those lines?
Yeah.
I mean, where are those lines being, you know... it's a real problem. It's a problem because we have to answer the question, not in general, what do women want? What do we need? What do people need? You know, I mean, how are we going to structure a society that does allow for differences and equality? And some equity and some equality and some, you know, reality, fact-based understanding of the world.
You're speaking in a way that some women and a lot of men might say, wait a second, I'm not that person that I hear there. What responsibility do men have in this fight for women's equality?
Oh, I think they have a lot of responsibility. First of all, I've been in the belly of the beast. I was married for 30 years. Okay, so I lived with a man. I loved him very deeply. It became very difficult. You know, the responsibility is to see another. And it's not just women, but it is very much with women, to see another individual as a full human person, you know, somebody that is responsible to get respect, compassion, understanding. And I don't really believe that very many people, and some women also, you know, I mean, we see each other almost as avatars. And now with AI, there's no filler. I mean, just look at the presenters on television. They're all looking alike.
Yeah.
You know, and they're even revving up people who are dead, like Carolyn Bessette now, you know, who was killed 30 years ago, becomes a style icon, you know. So everybody is now buying that stuff. So where is the individuality? So now that everybody is sort of molded into this one thing called woman, although we can't really define it, you know, we can't define it, but everybody is molded into this thing called women, then the response to them, because, you know, I mean, when I read the Epstein files, and I'm very rarely shocked. You can imagine doing the work that I do and the way I think, I think people can do anything, you know? It's like the head, like Viktor Frankl, their heads are in clouds and their feet are in shit, you know? And we have to navigate that difference. But when I read that, oh yes, you know, pussy is not high caloric, or I'm going to use, pubic hairs for, you know, to pick my teeth, or the vagina is really just an extension of a woman's body. You know, the body is just, you know, hanging there so you can use the vagina. I mean, the objectification, I mean, and the the fact that, you know, you can have, or I can have conversations with 15 or 20 or 30 different people, and they'll all be the same conversation because they're all reading the same things. It's as if, you know, the program has just been zipped into the mind. I mean, they're afraid of AI. I think, you know, the way we've been conditioned already is very disturbing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the objectification, and everything becomes a transaction, and everything has a value that somebody else puts on it. You know, like Oscar Wilde, everyone knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. Mm-hmm. And that really is what we're living in now. Nothing really has value. We've lost a sense of, you know, I won't use the word, I don't use the word sacred, but value, that yeah. The fact that we can think, that we can love, that we can move through all of this darkness now towards both an inner and an outer light, says that there is something different, special. There is a responsibility that we have.
So let's cast ourselves back to 1970.
Yes.
Well, there are two periods of fascinating history that we're going to have to totally skip. So first, we're going to completely skip your early years where you trained to be a concert pianist, maybe before we can go on, you could say a little bit about what is it about a person that makes them be that person who would train to be a concert pianist, study psychology, end up becoming an important person in the history of women's health and all the other things that you're doing that, you know, in your introduction, you didn't want to say.
What is it about me? It's an intrinsic trust in myself, which I've always noticed and always had. It's the fact that, you know, things come to me and I feel them organically and I want to do this and I trust that my decision is the right decision and I follow my own voice. I follow it. You know, I mean, a lot of people have their dreams, right? And say, oh, I would love to do this. I would love to. I do it. You know, I do it. I take the risks. And then, of course, I had, I had no avatars. I had no role models until I went into a library and read about Elizabeth I. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, followed sort of this. I think it was this intrinsic trust in me. And I don't know where it came from, or maybe I would look at my parents and I'd always feel some, you know, that I have better ideas. And sometimes, a lot of times I did. And the fact that I wasn't put off if I failed or if I, you know, something, so I fell off the bike, I got back on it, you know? Mm-hmm.
So you trained as a concert pianist,
yeah.
Then you moved to psychology. And you trained
right.
as that. You ended
right.
up working in your future husband's medical practice.
That's right.
So start us off 1970 when abortion became legal in New York.
Okay. So abortion, you know, that was 3 years before Roe v. Wade. Abortion is legalized in New York and four other states, decriminalized, okay? And my husband was very involved in HIP and socialized medicine. It's like HIP and Kaiser Permanente, you know, on the West Coast. And he was very progressive. And he wanted to bring to HIP abortion services because he used to work in Bellevue and he was on what they call the Midnight Express. And this is when abortion was illegal, where doctors would start, you know, an abortion and with a patient, with a woman, and then they would bring them into the hospital and say, this is a DNC or she's bleeding. So they would come in, or women who just tried to self-abort. You know, this is what a woman died in Bill Baird's arms. That's what motivated him to become such an activist. So he was motivated to start a small center. And I was reading philosophy, criminology, going to, you know, school. And feminism, nothing. I mean, the only thing that I remember was seeing Gloria Steinem on the television saying, we're not going to call everybody Miss. And, you know, something with the bunnies and, you know, Hugh Hefner or whatever. That's all. And, you know, because it seemed romantic to me. It was romantic. It was very new, you know. So I said, sure, I'll get involved. And my involvement was from the first patient that came. She came from New Jersey because abortion was illegal at that time in New Jersey. And I was 25 years old.
Wow.
And I said, what am I going to say to her? What do I say to her? And she was white. She had three children. She was Catholic. She was married. And we went into a room together. And I said to her, you know, this is the first time I'm doing this. And I understand this is the... She said, I would never have had an abortion, but I just can't afford another. And my way of being is always very accepting and very open. So we just talked. And I stayed with her during her abortion, because at that time there was no giving, no anesthesia. So I had to take my rings off, and she was squeezing and holding my hand and telling her when to breathe, because it's, you know, painful with very bad period cramps. And as she was laying there, I had this epiphany that this is the most powerful decision a woman can make. And at the same time, she's at her most vulnerable. Now, why is it powerful? Because she's making a decision whether or not to bring another life into the world. So I was never one to say, you know, it's just blood and tissue. It's not just blood and tissue. If you don't have the abortion in 9 months, usually give birth, okay? So you are making a decision to terminate this growing fetus. And that is an extremely powerful, it's a life and death decision. Women do not have the power of life and death in anything. The patriarchy, the establishment has it in terms of the criminal justice system and in terms of who goes to war, okay, and when we do. So with abortion, that is why it is so powerful, one of the reasons why it's so strongly opposed. And then the vulnerability. You know, I mean, in the early years, there was a lot in counseling where we'd have to talk about, you're not going to die. This is a safe, legal procedure. And, you know, you lay in that primal position with your legs spread and, you know, you give over your trust to someone like that. And with all of the, you know, coat hangers and horrible things that people had in your mind, all the things that they've brought back or trying to bring back, stigma, shame, you know, so that level of trust and vulnerability with that power was very strong. And I had this epiphany, and then it became my life's work. Yeah, that's how it happened. And now I feel like I'm in that movie Groundhog Day, because I'm doing the same thing. You know, how many people can relive their youth?
Yes. God, that is...
I'm a little tired, you know?
Yeah, oh my goodness, yeah.
It is extraordinary.
This is your host, Suki Wessling. When Merle Hoffman opened one of the first freestanding women's health clinics in the country, there was no defined field of women's health. Abortions had been provided in secret, illegally. Merle was a psychologist and businesswoman, not a doctor. But she had to build not just a new business, but a prototype of what we now know as a women's health clinic. We start here by addressing Merle's view of abortion and its importance to women's autonomy, because understanding that is fundamental to understanding why Merle fights the way she does for women's right to this procedure. I thought what you said was really worth dwelling on for a minute because, you know, there have been over the years various messages that the pro-choice movement has tried to give about abortion, you know, safe, legal, and rare, it's my body, my choice, et cetera, et cetera. But I feel like what you get at by admitting, by not admitting, because that sounds like it's
facing
guilt, facing that this is
this a determination of a potential. Absolutely. And I was the only one in the pro-choice movement because it was always, it's just blood and tissue. It is not, you know, again, move away from the difficult parts of life, from the real part, from the parts of life that make you a moral chooser, that make you someone with courage. And that's why I always say, you know, you have to stand by this. It is a moral choice. I myself had an abortion. It's important that women come out of this closet. You know, they have, again, stigmatized this. And it's also important to realize that this is really only in this country. You know, a woman came in for her 36th abortion to Choices, and that's what motivated me to do all my work in Russia, because there is no other way to control fertility. You know, so women were continually having kitchen table abortions.
So you founded Choices Women's Medical Center in 71.
Right.
What was your goal in founding it as a women's medical center?
Well, it was medical, okay? I mean, obviously. And understand that there was no path. You know, when you talk about pioneering, this is the most pioneering thing. It's like Monday, abortion is a crime, a sin, you're a murderer. You're, the worst thing that a woman can do Tuesday, if it is legal, they're lining up, you know, around the corners to get them. You know, I mean, that is such a radical shift, you know, and all of a sudden, so I had to learn how to answer the phone, I trained counselors, I was doing the payroll and, you know, calculating tax. I was doing everything, because it was a very small operation, you see. And then I started, and it was so creative, because, I mean, how do you deal with this? I mean, there's no path. You just land on planet legal abortion, you know?
And, you know, something I read pointed out that there wasn't, we think of, there's a whole discipline now of women's health.
And there was nothing there.
There was nothing. Can you explain what that was like?
Well, yeah, nothing. What it was like. So you were going into a situation, you needed doctors for this, right? Because they were the ones that were going to do the procedure. Now, what you had historically was the physician was like a god. You know, physician articulates, you do this, you do that. Nobody questioned the doctor. So what I found in the beginning is something that I called iatrogenic pregnancies, which must mean caused by the system. Caused by their doctors. So women would come in and say, you know, my doctor never told me to refit my diaphragm, you know, after I had my last child. So it wasn't fitting. I didn't use it. So I got pregnant. My doctor told me to use the pills. He said, I give all my women the pills and I don't like pills and they made me sick and I never told. So there was a lot of women who would come in who had unwanted pregnancies because of both the ignorance and the prejudice of their physicians. So that's when I developed patient power. Mm-hmm. And the whole list of you have a right to second opinions, you have a right to question your doctor. And, you know, that became the theoretical framework for the Patient's Bill of Rights, the federal Patient's Bill of Rights. So I saw this. I mean, look, power gives up nothing without demands. You know, that's Che. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to come in with a barrel of a gun there. You know, so I said, you have to come in to your doctor. You're either going to take a friend because you're going to be nervous, so they're going to be there to make sure you're asking the right questions. Or you take a tape recorder. Or you have things written down. So it was extraordinarily radical at the time, you know. Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, it's really, as I said, it's become the Patient's Bill of Rights, federal Patient's Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
So that was what was going on. And, you know, then I was hiring and firing doctors when I was 25 and 26 years old. Mm-hmm. So it was very interesting.
And they were mostly men or all men?
All of them were men at that time. All of them were men at that time. Yes, they were mostly men. And they're still, you know, I never put anything down to sexism or all of that stuff, things that happened to me. But I know that that's part of it because I'm basically the only one standing, you know, and I'm only growing. And a lot of other clinics have folded and have gone there. And I call them paid enemies. There's staff that try to work sometimes against me, competitors. But, you know, I mean... My other mantra, those bastards are never getting me. So going and going and going, you know. So,
so you mentioned that you really didn't have any interest in feminism and the women's movement. I would assume that once you opened the first abortion clinic in New York City, you started to interact with women activists. And what was that like for you since you'd never been an activist?
Well, it was quite interesting because, to be a really good leader, you have to know how to follow. And I think, you see, that was one thing that I learned, I think, through the music is the respect for the teacher. You know, somebody comes before you. There's a lot of matricidal kind of thinking with young women. They want to just get rid of these old girls and do it again, do it themselves, because they have to, they know better, you know. But I never had that feeling. So I never joined organizations. I led them. I created the organizations and, you know, was always one of the leaders. So I formed the National Abortion Federation, National Coalition of Abortion Providers, New York Pro-Choice Coalition. I mean, I worked very well, very, very well in coalitions because I don't have much of an ego for it. You know, for me, I want the right answer, the right strategies, and the right tactics, you know. In the beginning, you want to be quoted. And after I was quoted in the New York Times when I was 27, and they did a whole piece about me, you know, then I could die, right? You mean, everything else is posthumous.
You made it to the New York Times.
That's it, man. I can just take a deep breath and just stop.
Did you have any clashes? Because I'm just imagining you as this woman just who goes out and does stuff, woman, you know, interacting with women who have been working in these activist organizations.
Yes,
and it
course.
Seems like it might have been difficult for you and for them.
No, because you know why? Because I always listened, you know, and I understood. I could really place myself in the position. And if somebody says, well, I know, and I said, okay. And you know, if they make a good enough case, let's say we're sitting around the table, we're having a big discussion. And, you know, are we going to do this or are we going to do that? And I put something up and somebody says, well, you know, I don't think that's going to work. It's going to do this, that, yeah. And if they do a better one, that's fine. It's the same thing with my daughter. She makes I want to do this. Give me $50 for that. I say, tell me why. And if she makes a good enough, you know, argument, I'll consider it. Because I just want the best outcome. That's where my vision and my goal is. I want to make this action the best. I want to make this organization the best. Whatever does that, I don't care. Mm-hmm. You know, so And they work with me. I work very well with Coalition. I have no problem. They can have problems with me at times, and I know that, and it's, but you know, I grew dinosaur skin after all of these years, and I really don't take things personally. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say, you know, somebody can't hurt me. And sometimes it does, you know, it gets through and somebody will say something. But basically, I don't take it personally.
Merle Hoffman opened New York's first standalone abortion clinic in 1971. She was young, not interested in politics, and had no idea that she was about to do pioneering work in the field of women's health. When Roe v. Wade was decided 2 years later, giving all American women the right to choose whether to carry a pregnancy, Merle saw changes in her patient population. But she says she kept her head down and out of politics until a congressman named Henry Hyde realized that if the anti-abortion movement couldn't make the procedure illegal, at least they could start chipping away at it.
Well, the first thing that happened was we saw a change, obviously, in our patient population because we didn't have as many patients from out of town as came before. The second thing, the codification with Roe and the nationalization just opened the floodgates even more. So we saw even more patients. It got busier. What really started to happen in terms of the politics for me was, and I'll tell you how I was politicized, which is very interesting because I wasn't, you know, in the feminist movement or dealing anything with what was going on there. I was working and reading and doing my thing. All of a sudden, I hear Henry Hyde come out in 77 and say, well, you know, he was passing the Hyde Amendment, and he said, if we can't save all the babies, we'll save the babies of the poor, so we'll cut off Medicaid funds for their abortions. And these were the women I saw every day. And these were, you know, the small heroes and heroines, I mean, who are trying to make ends meet, have three or four kids, and they're struggling, and they have to have these procedures. But no, they're going to be cut off for any support at all. And I was incensed. So what did I do? I went up to my office. I took out a piece of paper. I wrote my first screed, one page. I had it all printed up, like a 200 pieces of it. And because the clinic was right across from Queens College, where I graduated, I went for undergraduate school. I went over to Queens College and I went into down the halls and I just started to knock on the doors of the classrooms. And I said, my name is Merle Hoffman. I went here. May I come in and dress the class? And because, you know, I didn't look at all threatening and I'm carrying some papers. So they said, sure. I go in and I said, women's rights are in a state of emergency, which I also said in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral when I did the first pro-choice civil disobedience. They're in a state of emergency. You know, poor women, minority women, black women are now they're discriminated against. And, you know, this was middle class, mainly white kids. And what I get was a lot of shoulder shrugs, you know, like, well, I can always go here or, you know, somebody knows somebody in Puerto Rico or I can go there. And that really seared it into me, the class and the race disparities and the fact that, you know, nobody gives a damn except if it's going to impact them. So that was a very powerful motivator for me. And every year, you know, they have to pass the Hyde Amendment, and Clinton passed it and Obama passed it. They all pass it because they have to give a little to the Catholic Church and they have to give it here. And it is still in place. Okay. It's still in place. Hmm. And as I said, it's a yearly thing and it can just be the stroke of a pen can get rid of that. And Biden didn't do it. Nobody did it, you know, because they have to do it across the aisle kind of play. So that's what politicized me.
You had your own abortion for...
When I was 32.
32.
Yes.
And you were married.
I was married. I had all the accoutrements. I had the apartment. I had the husband. I had, you know, but I knew in my heart that I couldn't give the time and effort. And I remember, you know, putting my hand on my stomach and saying, it's not time, I'm sorry, little one. And I had the choices.
How do you feel that influenced, or did it not influence at all, your resolve to help other women?
The impact of that, you know, has had a lot of different expressions in different ways that I really can't define. You know, I had to go through it in a way like a rite de passage. You know, it was almost like, now I'm laying my body down here too, you know, so I'm part of this. So that was sort of important. I think it also informed the fact that I never thought I would have a child until I decided to adopt one when I was 58.
In 2012, you published a memoir, Intimate Wars. Why did you choose to do a memoir then? And do you think there was anything that happened that made you feel like now is the time to mm-hmm. sum up what I've done?
Mm-hmm. My mother and my dearest, closest friend both died. And death has always been something that's been with me, you know, from when I was aware that I wasn't going to be here. And it's something that I've always thought about. I think it's very important to be aware of death, mostly at all times, so you can, you know, be present for the time that you're given, gifted, whatever. But it was losing them, and I didn't know, and thinking about my own mortality, and that I wanted to put this down for Sasha. You know, I wanted to have my own record because I know people will write about me or say things, and I just wanted it from my perspective, my narration, to be out there.
Mm-hmm. We hadn't won anything in particular recently in that time, of course. You still had the Hyde Amendment. We still have the Hyde Amendment. You still had a lot of battles about abortion rights, but it seems like maybe, did you feel that we had reached something, like gotten up on a step as far as women's health that we weren't necessarily going to back off of, or were you still feeling tentative?
I don't think it was in any sense political in that way, because I don't think of it that way. And that's another thing. You see, I think this is a generational struggle. And I consider that I'm a small part of what has been going on for a long time, you know, and that I was put in this position, in this place at this time, and I'm going to do as much as I can. I feel that all of this idea of winning and losing, this is not what this is about. This struggle for equality, social justice, what you want to term it, humanity, seeing each other, you know, as full-fleshed, embedded spirits that can choose light or darkness. I mean, this will go on forever as long as people exist. So it's like Camus and Sisyphus. I call it Sisyphus, you know, pushing that rock up, and it always comes back down. And in the end, and this is why Camus' book is so extraordinary, he said, in the end, we must imagine Sisyphus happy. Now, why would he be happy doing this? Because it's in the struggle, it's in the work. It's the work. And Florence Kennedy, this wonderful friend of mine, would always say to me, girl, you got to love the struggle. You got to love the struggle. And I am very committed to that. You know, so when everybody goes, oh, we won this addendum, we won this, you won nothing. These are just little skirmishes, The war is continuing. Get used to it and just commit yourself, if you really want to commit yourself, not to one march where you wear a pink pussy hat with ears, but commit yourself to this every single day. Sorry, but, you know.
You're just a little passionate about this. No,
lot,
it's great.
You see, I'm a lot passionate mm-hmm. about it. And it's quite, that has not left.
No.
And it will never leave, because that's, you know, that was my epiphany and my road to Damascus. And I was converted. It's like I chose to be chosen.
Uh-huh. You know? You chose to be chosen. Uh-huh. Maybe it was because you actually listened to the voice that was choosing you, and many of us don't.
You know, maybe I did. Maybe that voice becomes inside me, and instead of saying I can't trust myself, I said I will trust that and move on that.
This is your host, Suki Wessling. Merle Hoffman started an abortion clinic as a business venture, but Merle doesn't do anything, it appears, without thinking deeply about all sides of the issue. We're going to move to the present-day fight for abortion rights, but we'll also explore the understanding Merle has developed over many years of fighting about this issue. On the one hand, there is Merle's understanding of the pro-life movement, what motivates them, and how they work. That understanding motivates her critique of the pro-choice movement, which frustrates her while at the same time she still pours her heart, soul, and body into this fight that she calls generational. We're speaking at a time when access to abortion is at its lowest since Roe v. Wade gave women the right to control their fertility in 1973. I asked her to sum up where we are and where we need to go.
Our reproductive capacities are embedded within us, and I absolutely feel that the right to determine when and whether or not to parent, you know, is as transcendent a right as the right to worship or free speech. I mean, that's how, you know, important it is, but it's the only right where it's embedded. It's in somebody's body. We're saying, you know, we will either reproduce or we won't. And we will use these processes, birth control and abortion, to determine our fertility. And that is something that was developed over all of the 50 years, you know, through our bodies ourselves, through, you know, a lot of different writings and understandings and clinics all across the country who don't only do abortions, but, you know, had done counseling and other types of services and helped women in a multiplicity of ways. Most of those are gone, you know? I mean, even I see there are slave states, I call them, you know, and then free states. And even in the free states, a lot of the freestanding clinics are going.
Yeah.
So we've lost that. And not only have we lost that, we've lost all the work and the theoretical basis. So that's why at Choices, I have a great deal of training programs. We train social workers. We train physicians on how to do the procedures. I'm working on now my third book, which is going to be really more about counseling. So I'm trying to leave as much of a part of legacy that I can. This is what was lost. This is what we have here. And it is so critical. And I don't want to not have... say this in this conversation, I do place a great deal of responsibility on the pro-choice movement itself for being in the position of where we are now. First of all, they didn't follow the first rule of war, which is to know and respect your enemy. I mean, these people are crazy. They don't know what they're talking about. Look at them with their yellow feet and they're working around with this and that. You know, well, these little crazy people have done quite a number on this issue. And so, you know, they can never overturn Roe. That's crazy. That's crazy.
Can we pause there? Because I want you to talk about, I know you've had a lot of interactions with the pro-life movement.
Oh, many.
And it seems like maybe you could spread a little understanding of who are they and why, how do you see them?
Well, how do I see them? You know, I debated Jerry Falwell. I have relationships. I had somewhat relationships with a lot of these people. There's a Sister Dorothy that's outside of my clinic and she prays for my soul. And, you know, actually she's in the last page of my book, Intimate Wars. I have a respect. Why do I have a respect? A basic respect because they firmly have their belief systems. And it's not one belief system. I mean, there's not one pro-life movement. You know, there's different beliefs. There's the abolitionists. There's the moderates. You know, there's the terrorists. Fortunately, that's reduced quite a bit. But they firmly, firmly believe, and it's a lot religious, but there are atheists that are also pro-life, that these are human beings and that people who don't see them as the other and respect them as the other, you know, I mean, you can't because they're God's gift in a sense. And it's just like you can't spill, you know, a test tube of sperm with the IVF stuff because it has God's imprimatur. I mean, there is a lot of religion in this. There is. So I understand that. I also, because I did a lot of work on animal rights, and I, you know, I can't bear children or animals being abused. I can't stand it, you see. And I can project that out, you know, but these animals are not in my body and they're nobody's body. I mean, it's like once they're here, they're mine, not God's, not the pro-life. It's in my body. This is my territory. I want to defend my territory, you see? So I do very much understand them. And it's because of that that I deal with them in a different way. Deal with it in a different way.
And you were talking about the pro-choice movement and how the mistakes they've made. So talk more about that.
Yeah, well, the prime mistake is just seeing them in a very diminished, crazy, there wasn't, you know, I've been sued by the Thomas More Society. And Thomas, you know, Thomas More is the patron saint of lawyers, and he put his head on the block because he would not sign a specific thing of Henry VIII. These are very, very committed people. I can't not respect that. You know, do I agree with what they're committed to? No. And I'll fight it to the end of my days. But, you know, I mean, there's two of us when we debate. And that's what we share. We share the commitment to something profound that we risk our lives for. And these people have been executed, which they should have been for killing some of the providers. But so that's the first thing. The second thing is you're not going to change anybody's mind. I stopped debating after a while because basically what it is you're speaking to already people who are already committed. And when I was put on with the brother of the person who had killed both a physician and two workers in the clinic, and they wanted to compare this, I said, there is no comparison and I'm not debating this. Nor, it's like, go to Auschwitz and give me 5 minutes from the guards and give me 5 minutes from the victims. You know, it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing. And I've gone up against them for decades, and they've gotten so much more brazen. I mean, in Tennessee, they've just put up something that would give the death penalty to women who have had abortions. You know, I mean, this is serious stuff. So when it gets to that, you know, you have to understand that they're not going away. They don't see time in the way that we do. I mean, they're in this for not only this long haul, but for as long as it takes, because they're warriors for righteousness. Their banner is white, you see. Ours is stained with the blood of the fetuses and babies that we've killed. So because their banner is so pure, you know, that's what makes them, in their minds, God's warriors. What can I say? What can I say? You know, I mean, it's people who fight for their beliefs. I mean, but then maybe you could say, well, maybe ideology and maybe religion are really the basis of all the conflict. I mean, if we didn't have that, what would we fight about? Land, you know?
Yeah. Power, I guess. Money.
Yeah,
sex.
Power, money. It's, because it's, it's going to be one thing or another.
Merle Hoffman is not a religious person. But alongside her quest to serve women and promote women's health, she has lived life as a seeker. Most of Merle's opponents on the abortion question cite religion as their fundamental purpose. For Merle, it's spirituality.
I've always been, or as long as I can remember, on a spiritual quest. Now, my quest started when well, I'm Jewish and I was raised secular Jewish, you know. I mean, we didn't do much of anything. I went, you know, to Sunday school, and I didn't have a Jewish education in that sense. But I'm very curious. So I studied with the groups of positive thinking. When they came and knocked on my door for the Jehovah's Witnesses, I let them in. Sure. You know, I mean, we're not talking about movies. Let's talk about the nature of reality. So I let them in. And then when I got so involved in Elizabeth I and Mary Queen of Scots, I wanted to become a Catholic because, you know, I like the incense and the bee. It has a lot of paraphernalia, you know, and, you know, all with her long veils, or so that was part of it. Then I went to, when I was in early 20s, I think I went to the Church of Truth, and then I studied with the Christian Scientists. Now, this was really interesting because there's a lot of them, especially on the Upper East Side, where, you know, where I went at that point. They were doctors and professionals and everything, and they would get up and they would testify. I had 5-stage cancer. It metastasized to everything. And, you know, and then I went to the practitioners, and I just couldn't wrap my mind around, but I did go and speak to a practitioner because that also interested me. And then I've read about other religions, some of the Eastern religions. And then I was a very strong atheist. Then, you know, I think, well, I look at the intentionality, what I see as intentionality and design. So then I said, well, there's got to be something out there, and, you know, and then I go to, well, maybe it's all a matrix, you know, none of it is real, you know, but, you know, I can live in the question.
You can live in the question.
I can live. And that's what the great thing is. I'm living in this question. I don't have to know. I don't know if we'll ever know. But the question is so incomparably, you know, deep, profound, interesting, frustrating. You know, I can look at my dog, how perfect the little thing is, and say, well, somebody designed, you know, this is here, that's there, you know, and the awe in nature. So I don't know. All I know is that it's an extraordinary sort of shock and awe every day to just be conscious and be alive. And I think we have responsibility. It's what can we give back into this world, into this system? It's like, ask not what the world can do for you. Ask what you can do within and for the world. So.
Yeah, for sure. And I want to get to Dobbs.
Ah, Dobbs.
But first, before I get to Dobbs, I want to ask, you did all this important work in the 70s. And when I look at the 70s, despite, you know, a little back and forth, it was really sort of up, up, up for women. You know, when you started working, the majority of women in this country couldn't open their own credit card account.
I got one of the first American Express cards. Do you know I'm on 52 years with American Express? I was one of the first women that didn't have to get my husband. I am 52 years on my
That's
American
great.
Express. And they still don't give me enough points. You know?
Darn them. They should, because
you're
such a good spokesman for them.
I know. And they don't know this history. And when they say, oh, you're 52 years. And I said, do you know there was a time? And so I educate them all.
Yeah. And so it was a lot of up, up, up.
Right.
And what,
right.
You know, say a little bit about the feeling in that time.
Oh, yeah.
And then move to Dobbs.
Okay, so the feeling there, it was a salad days, right? I mean, the best thing you could do was work in an abortion clinic. That was, I mean, if you were a feminist, if you were an activist, if you worked in an abortion clinic, that was the, you know, penultimate of doing activist work. And of course, you know, it came off of all the writing of Kate Millett, Phyllis Chesler, all of the theoretical stuff. So yes, and then, you know, gaining the right to abortion was a major victory. So correct. There was definitely that feeling of, you know, I am woman, hear me roar kind of thing. And we were doing it. So you know, here I am, I'm, you know, hiring and firing doctors and, you know, doing, got New York Times and everybody is, you know, and not only me, but the, just the whole thing about what women are doing and, you know, all of that. And then I think it was in the late 70s when I got a call that the antis were starting to demonstrate. I mean, it took them a little while to really rev it up, and then they started to rev it up. And then the, what did they say, the blush is off the peach or something. Just, it wasn't just all, you know, rainbows and mm-hmm. unicorns.
And it's all, that was also the time that the ERA did not quite pass.
So. Correct. And in the beginning, you know, I mean, the evangelicals, they didn't see abortion that way. It became political. It became very political in terms of the fall of communism and who was going to be the enemy and what is the red meat for bringing in the Republican demographic. So I have more of an analysis of that in the second book, but that's what happened. Now, Dobbs, you know, we knew that cases were going up to the Supreme Court. And, you know, in the beginning, there was no sense of urgency because nobody really felt, as I said to you before, there was the feeling that it could never happen. And so their feet were basically up on it, you know, it's not going to happen. And during that time, before Dobbs was decided, I got involved with an organization called Rise Up for Abortion Rights. And this was a very radical organization that I co-initiated with a couple of women, Sarah Taylor and others, that was saying we have to stop this somehow. And if we don't stop it, we have to bring it to public consciousness. I don't know if you remember, but prior to Dobbs, there were thousands of people marching in different states. They all had these big green banners. I mean, we were doing very radical actions. You know, I was speaking all over the place. We got young people involved. They were leaving their classrooms, but it was close to the summertime, too, I have mm-hmm. to say, to carry over. But we were really the only group that was out there saying, do something, do something. We did a whole thing in front of the Supreme Court, and hardly anybody was there. But you know something? I've done actions where I'm the only one standing out there. And sometimes, you know, sometimes that feels the best, you know, it does. It feels so, God, feels so powerful. Mm-hmm. You know? So what happened with that is, you know, after Dobbs came down and everybody was so shocked, and this is amazing, the people from Rise Up were sleeping on the floor, sleeping on the pavement in front of the Supreme Court, and the decision came down, and there were just hysterics. You know, there are people from Planned Parenthood, other groups there, other groups. What do we do? It's the worst thing in the world. What are we going to do? And only Rise Up got and said, we are going to fight on. And there was no tears there. You know, we went out, we marched here, we marched there. I had about 16 reporters in my apartment. And that was my message. My message is I'm going to mourn for 5 minutes and then I'm going to organize. You know, mm-hmm. and I got very angry at a lot of people in the movement, very angry, because it took them 2 months. There, if you feel upset, come cry. There was this whole thing. People couldn't go back to class because they were so upset about Dobbs or this. I just can't. I talk a lot about courage, you know. You have to practice it, you know. You have to. It's just, you can't just wash yourself in this luxury of your own victimization emotions because it's not about you. Mm-hmm. So that was something that got me more frustrated than anything else. Was there a despair? Was it? Yeah, of course, all the work, all the years, but yet, I knew it's a Sisyphean test. That mm-hmm. rock just happened to roll right down on my toe. So, okay, push it off and start pushing it back up because that's what it takes. And that's what it takes.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not many people. I'm sitting in my chair at Choices. It's 54 years. I was a baby when I started. It's very hard for me to really... You know, fathom that.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes commitment, it takes persistence, and it takes the responsibility of doing that. That's what it takes.
So where do we go from here?
We keep going where we can. We are not in a good position. We are not in a good position because they've managed to box in, you know, a 52-53 state kind of battle. This is a battle on multiple fronts. So there's not enough resources for all of these fronts. There's not an agreement on how you're going to get a unified movement to come out and say, just to hear and no further. I mean, Black Lives Matter. I mean, people were out for days marching. I didn't see any marches with this. I mean, it's just because there's this closet about this. Now, we can debate, and there is a room for a big debate on how much any of these marches make a difference in the long run. But I think it's important to get your voice out and just be heard, you know, but that's something that just is not happening either.
Well, and I think it's important also for us not to be lonely Sisyphuses on the hill.
We're all going to push up those rocks together.
Because it's an amazingly powerful feeling for people to get together. And it's interesting because, you know, so many people are coming out now as far as the political rallies, not abortion rights and specific,
right.
And so many people who have never gone to any rallies,
right.
And I think that they expected anger and frustration, which yes, of course there is, but there's just like also this joy in being together and knowing what's
right. The joy of resistance,
yeah,
and it's the joy of the struggle. Mm-hmm. That's what the joy, because you're right. You can't. There's a loneliness there, but there's also when you come together, then you feel that collective power. And then, you know, you're next to somebody that you can just hug, or you look at them and you know, well, you're my comrade here now, you know.
Yeah.
But the point is that it can get performative, it can get formulaic. And if you just do that, it's going to go nowhere.
So what would you say that young women can do, should do, what would help them figure out where to go? Because, you know, there's only so much that those people like you who were on the front lines in the 70s can do at this point. We need the young women to be joining in.
There are definitely some young women that are very involved and try to create, funds. They were wonderful. You know, after Dobbs came down, there were funds, feminist funds that were created and ways to help women, you know, travel from slave states to free states. Individually, it's difficult because, again, you know, when what is being sold is a definition of womanhood or femininity, and you know, you just try to be the avatar that you want to be. I think the important thing is to think. There is a voice within you. There is something within you that may have been, you know, quieted for a time. It doesn't have to be quieted forever. You know, I think to think, to just even start talking about it. You know, people are very amazed when they even ask their families or, you know, people that they know, hey, you know, I heard this thing about abortion. Did you ever know anyone? Sometimes that'll just, you know, open up a channel for people to talk, because it's still something that people don't really feel comfortable about talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, 1 in 4 women are projected to have abortions in their lifetime. That is an enormous constituency. And then they're their friends and their mothers and their partners, of course. You asked about the men. There is a tremendous role for men. They have wives and sisters and daughters and nieces. I mean, we are in this together, but in an environment where everybody's in their own silo, you see? So how do you break out of those bubbles? And the first thing is to realize that you're in one. You're in one. You're not going to break out of it. And so I would say, listen to that still small voice. Talk about it. Think about the fact that you only have a certain amount of time on this being alive, right? Only a certain amount. How do you want to spend it? And youth goes quickly and sexuality changes. I mean, it's all of And just think and trust a little bit in your still small voice within yourself. Mm-hmm. And being political, that's something that everyone comes to in a different way. You know, if it's just to look in the mirror and say, I want to do something meaningful besides scroll on my phone or buy, you know, a Birkin bag or whatever it is, mm-hmm. you know, or worship at the golden calves of celebrity. Yeah. And where are the role models here? Where are they? You know, I know that I'm one for the people that I work with. And it's very important to me that when somebody looks at my life and says, well, you know, she stuck with it. She was there. I mean, that's important that you do something. Mm-hmm. So yeah. That's what I would say. Am I, you know, do I have great optimism? Not at this time, not with what's going on. I would say I'm realistically hopeful, which means hope, you know, the last thing that was in Pandora's box. So, of course, you know, I mean, there always has to be that, right? Mm-hmm. Right.
That rock's always going to come back and crush your toes, but toes heal and friends come and help you push it back up, right?
That's right. Just be comfortable living within the questions.
Many thanks to Merle Hoffman for the amazing, passionate hour of conversation. You can find links to her books and information we discussed on babbelry.com. The song Show Yourself is by Ayla Nerio, and the song Real Woman is by Sonic Mystery, both courtesy of freemusicarchive.org. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The Babbelry.
The Babbelry is produced with support from KSQD Radio in Santa Cruz, California.
Find us on major podcast platforms or at babbelry.com.